Chapter 16, Quintland, 1935. The year was 1935, and in New York and other cities across the country, diphtheria campaigns continued at full steam. Gas and light bills contained notices imploring the reader, "Get your child immunized for diphtheria." Boy Scouts met not only to talk about ornithology or carpentry, but to receive admonitions from local health officials to make sure their younger siblings received the new diphtheria shot. Others wore buttons given to them by their doctors that inquired, "Have you been shicked?" A reference to the shick test, a simple skin prick procedure to determine if someone had already acquired diphtheria immunity. But none of those things would have an impact as large as an event taking place in Canada's most popular tourist attraction, Quintland. The two-lane road that separated the Dion quintuplets' nursery from their parents and the home they were born in was full of cars. It had been doubled in width, huge parking lots constructed nearby, but it didn't matter. During the summer months outside of calendar, there were simply too many people. Nearly every house within miles of Quintland had rooms for rent to handle the overflow, and local teens were able to find employment, parking cars, or working the many gift shops. Two official viewing opportunities were provided to the public, one in the morning and another in the afternoon. A huge makeshift clock had been affixed to the top of a souvenir shop that read, "Next showing of the babies," its hands pointing towards 9:30. Another two signs read, "See original basket quintuplets were placed in after birth. Personal interviews and autographs free." Another sign read, "Madame Labelle, midwife of the quintuplets, extends to you a personal welcome and will be pleased to answer your questions. Autograph, no charge." Many who had come from far and wide sought not the autographs of the Dion's father or the council of midwives, but stones from the Dion farm, rumored to make barren women fertile. The Quintland souvenir shop would not allow these hopeful mothers and fathers-to-be to leave disappointed, and featured a large bin containing rocks from the surrounding area for those tourists interested in their own set of quintuplets. As 9:30 a.m. approached, hundreds of people were already lined up outside the barbed wire gate, ready to sprint inside the covered gallery that surrounded the quintuplets' playground. Inside the nursery, the girls had already woken from their individual cribs, each one personalized with their name and a wooden scroll that read in French, "Que le bon Jésus vous garde." May the good Lord watch over you. Before the girls were allowed outside, the entrance to the Quintland playground was opened and a mass of humanity poured through, anxious to secure a spot in the gallery. Once the crush had slackened, marshals strolled amidst the noisy devotees looking for cameras to abscond and issuing commands of silence or quiet. After the crowd had finally settled down, five little girls in identical white rompers were led onto the playground from the nursery in which they lived. Hushed exclamations of adoration filled the air as the quintuplets' most ardent fans could barely contain themselves. At the far end of the playground stood a cement pond in which the girls could cool off, though in winter, it could become solid ice. A 6-foot tower gave them plenty of chances to climb, but the most popular area was the center where a large sand pile provided opportunity to make mud pies and build castles. Lines of people pushed from behind, eager to catch a glimpse of the slightest stunt or mischievous behavior. Many who'd traveled from afar felt a close connection to the quintuplets, and in fact may have been able to see them more frequently than even the girls' parents. By the doctor's orders, the girls were only allowed a visit from their mother or father for half an hour each day and were mostly never able to see any of their other siblings. Devotees who had had their fill could exit the gallery and walk across the road to the enormous souvenir shop which the Dion's father had built. With little work and many other mouths to feed, Oliver Dion did his best to profit from the situation. The souvenir shop and adjoining restaurant he had erected drew hundreds of customers every day during the summer. But the girls' popularity surged much further than the little farm outside of Calendar, Canada. Across the world, hundreds of collectibles bore the Dion quintuplets' likeness. 20th Century Fox was readying a feature-length film called The Country Doctor, which would star the girls themselves and valiantly portray Dr. Defoe's heroics in the shimmering golden hues of Hollywood. While he would not appear as himself in the film, Defoe did find he was able to put his first-rate medical reputation to good use. Caro featured the discerning face of Dr. Defoe in magazine ads across the country, quoting him as saying, Karo is the only syrup served to the Dion quintuplets. Its maltose and dextrose are ideal carbohydrates for growing children. Another ad asked how quintuplets might relieve the coughing of chest colds. With Mustarol. And since Mustarol is used on the Quince, you must be sure it's just about the best cold relief made. Defoe's celebrity earned him a trip to the White House, where he was able to meet directly with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who no doubt discussed his plans to raise awareness of polio, a debilitating illness he himself was thought to have suffered from since 1921. Although Roosevelt had certainly brought recognition of what had been called infantile paralysis to the fore, the fear of polio was nearly non-existent at that time. Diphtheria was a far larger threat, and so, possibly inspired by his visit with the American president and with a nationwide reluctance to submit children to the new injection, the Quince doctor Defoe decided to lend his medical gravitas to the situation.